fight, don't wanna die, just wanna hear you cry. Who's gonna throw the very first stone? Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Richard Bonin, who is a producer at CBS News' 60 Minutes, working with Leslie Stahl. He has won 5 Emmys as well as an Overseas Press Club Award for his reporting in Iraq. He's the author of the new book, Arrows in the Night, Ahmad Chalabi's Long Journey to Triumph in Iraq. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Bonin.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you for having me.
And as we witness, we have witnessed the final exit of the U.S. from Iraq, already there are signs of deep fissures and perhaps even a renewed civil war with the Sunni vice president on the lam now, being charged with terrorism. The Iraqiya bloc has pulled out of the parliament. It is a mess by any measure, I think. And the consensus is, of course, that Iran is the winner of the Iraq war. And yet the neoconservative architects of this war are now claiming credit for the Arab Spring, saying that their actions in Iraq led to the Arab Spring. Where do you get a reality check in our body politics nowadays?
Yeah. Well, the bottom line reality check is in the Middle East, nothing is simple and nothing is easy. And, you know, trying to predict where Iraq is going to come out at this point is still too soon and too close to call. But we know for a fact that it hasn't turned out as advertised. I mean, we have 4,500 Americans dead, 100,000 Iraqis killed, upwards of $1 trillion spent. And I think the fundamental lesson of the war in Iraq is limits of power. We thought we could go in there and shape the outcome of future Iraq, a post-Saddam Iraq, and the Middle East. And we know, whatever our tensions, no matter how noble they may have been or misguided, we're simply unable to do so. And there are forces at play in Iraq in particular, in the Middle East in general, that we don't understand completely, and to the extent that we do, we're unable to control. And we're seeing that across the Middle East and in Iraq.
But one thing that's been haunting us for some time is why we went into the Iraq war, because there's never been a straight answer. You know, Greenspan said it was oil, Bush said it was democracy. It's changed a lot.
Weapons of mass destruction.
Mass destruction was the excuse. I mean, you know, there's a list of particulars. But what is so important about your book, Richard Bonin, Arrows in the Night, Ahmad Chalabi's Long Journey to Triumph in Iraq, is that it really does make pretty clear, and it's astounding when you think about it, that one man conned the greatest power on earth into a war that Martin Van Creewald, the Israeli historian, referred to as the greatest strategic mistake since Emperor Augustus invaded Germany in 9 AD.
Well, the astonishing thing is, to the extent Ahmad Chalabi conned us, he did it with our eyes wide open. You know, what he did is he came to this country in the 1990s. He had just fled Jordan, just fled a conviction for bank fraud in which he was sentenced to more than 20 years in hard labor. And he came to America where he had no constituency. He had no contacts in the Iraqi army. He had no political base in Iraq. He had no support in Washington. The Clinton White House was against him. The CIA was against him. The State Department was against him. And he systematically courted people of power and the levers of power in this country until he built a climate of opinion that made regime change in Iraq not only intellectually acceptable, but desirable. He systematically stoked the desire for regime change in Iraq over a 10-year period. And so when 9/11 happened, there was already a huge amount of steam built behind the idea of overthrowing Saddam. And he, you know, and his key partner, I mean, he had several sponsors throughout, first the CIA, then members of Congress, in particular the conservative leadership, and then ultimately the neoconservatives. And the neoconservatives had their own reasons, their own vision for post-Saddam Iraq. Chalabi had his. And when they met each other in the mid-1990s, they both saw in each other a way forward, the way forward. So the neocons wanted to go in, Chalabi wanted to go in, and he needed them, and they needed him. And why they needed him is because here they were advocating the overthrow of Saddam, and as Richard Perle told me, probably the leading neoconservative advocate for the overthrow of Saddam, what Perle told me is, you know, if we are a bunch of Americans advocating regime change in Iraq, you have to answer the question, well, after Saddam's gone, what's next? Who's next? And for them, Ahmad Chalabi was the answer. And once they had that piece of the puzzle, then they could move forward and make the case.
Well, he certainly saw himself as the leader, and of course it didn't transpire, and then he turned around and betrayed us to Iran. But just to go back to the extraordinary revelations in your book, Arrows in the Night, Richard Bonin, on day two of the Bush presidency, that's January the 21st of 2001, a meeting took place at Richard Perle's home with Paul Wolfowitz, Zalman Khalilzad, Doug Feist, Paul Wolfowitz,
all of the
John Hanna,
Perle, of course,
yeah.
All of whom would soon and John Hanna, all of whom would soon have leading positions in the Bush administration. John Hanna as a Middle East advisor to Vice President Cheney. And, of course, Wolfowitz and Feist as the number two and three people at the Pentagon, and Richard Perle as a senior advisor to both Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz. And finally, Zal Khalilzad as a special advisor to President Bush himself. They were all there on the day after Bush's inauguration. Richard Perle convenes the meeting, and he says, "We have won. Now it is time to get our policy enacted." And the policy was regime change in Iraq and replacing Saddam with their friend Ahmad Chalabi.
And the meeting was largely about him?
It was exclusively about him. It was exclusively about setting the stage, plotting their method for getting President Bush to adopt the policy of regime change in Iraq, and not only getting rid of Saddam, but then replacing Saddam with Chalabi. I mean, throughout the Clinton years, the 1990s, the idea of regime change in Iraq was a non-starter. And before Clinton, with Bush the father, George H.W. Bush, the idea of regime change was a non-starter, obviously. I mean, First President Bush, you know, had 700,000 troops on the doorsteps of Baghdad and decided to leave Saddam in power.
They understood the broader strategic and geopolitical reality, didn't they, that he was a check and balance against Iran?
Yes, they did. Nobody fooled themselves. Saddam was a brutal, evil dictator, but geostrategically, he was a bulwark against the spread of Iranian influence throughout the rest of the Middle East. And at bottom, you know, the issue was oil. And what Chalabi figured out was the fault line in U.S. foreign policy between our values as a people and our interests as a country. And for decades, starting with Kissinger and Nixon through Clinton, we valued stability and the free flow of oil from the Middle East to the West and Japan over democracy and the freedom of the Iraqi people. And as a people ourselves, that's difficult to swallow. But at the same time, overthrowing Saddam incurred huge geopolitical risks. And that's why I said at the beginning of this interview, what we've learned is the limits of power and the limits of our power to shape the outcome of an adventure like this. We thought we could overthrow Saddam and keep things in place. And as we've now discovered, you know, the whole Middle East is up for grabs.
Well, I would say that when you say we thought we could, I mean, largely it was the Bush...
Oh, policymakers. George W. Bush administration.
Exactly,
right.
Because his own father and Brent Scowcroft warned against it for the very reasons that you've just stated.
And you know, the point I strayed from is, I mean, originally George W. Bush campaigned against nation building, campaigned against the very notion of what he would eventually do in March of 2003, invade Iraq. And so when Richard Perle and Chalabi and Wolfowitz and Feith and Hanna met at Perle's house on the second day of the Bush presidency, what the challenge ahead of them was to get President Bush himself to make a U-turn on his own vision and his own campaign promises against regime change, against nation building in a country like Iraq. So that was what was at the heart of their meeting on the second day of the Bush presidency.
And it's worth noting that on the day that President Bush finally got out of Air Force One after 9/11 and met at Camp David, on that first meeting after the United States had been struck by al-Qaeda, Wolfowitz brings up an invasion of Iraq. And Richard Berman, just moving, because there's so much more to talk about here, moving to the actual invasion of Iraq, Rumsfeld, Powell, Tenet and company, they opposed Chalabi's idea of creating a provisional government with him at the head in Iraq. And is that the point where Chalabi then decides to court the Iranians, or was he already in touch with the Iranians?
No, he was already deeply ensconced with the Iranians. I mean, Chalabi's genius was from early on, he realized the road to Baghdad went through Washington, but he had to court Iran at the same time. And while he is courting the neoconservatives in Washington, he is insinuating himself at an ever higher level within the political and intelligence circles of the Iranian government. So by time the U.S. invasion occurs, I mean, Chalabi is meeting with the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps and all the top policymakers inside Iran. And what happened was, in Washington, there was a huge policy debate about what to do after the fall of Saddam. Everyone knew the fall of Saddam was certain and would be swift. The question is the day after. And the policy debate was whether the U.S. would occupy the country or turn it over to a provisional government led by Ahmad Chalabi. And that debate played out for months and months and months, and with the State Department, the CIA, much of the National Security Council against the Chalabi plan, and Paul Wolfowitz, Doug Feith inside the Pentagon basically pushing the provisional government plan.
So when the U.S. finds out that Chalabi has given away one of the most important secrets that the U.S. had, which is that it had broken Iran's communication code and was reading all of its mail, including communications between Baghdad and Tehran, that's when, of course, Bush gets really angry. But even then, the Pentagon, I guess Wolfowitz and Feith and company, keep stonewalling. And only after this treachery is revealed do they cut off their 10-year relationship with Chalabi's INC, which had received up to then $33 million in U.S. taxpayer money. When did he actually betray the U.S. to the Iranians in terms of telling them that we had intercepted Iran's secret code?
Well, you know, according to the multiple sources I interviewed, including non-CIA sources, I mean, Chalabi gave up the secret in the spring of 2004. He met with the head of the IRGC, this fellow named Soleimani, and the head of the Iranian government's station in Baghdad, and he and Chalabi and his aide told them that our NSA, the National Security Administration, had cracked their most secret code. It was the one code where the Iranians communicated worldwide in unguarded language, and including communicating information about terrorist attacks, whether it be in Lebanon or IED IED attacks and attacks against U.S. soldiers in Iraq. I mean, we had cracked that code and were able to read their most sensitive mail. And according to several of my sources, that is what Chalabi gave up in the spring of 2004. And the amazing thing is when the head of the NSA explained that to President Bush at an Oval Office meeting, President Bush ordered, you know, ties with Chalabi cut off, to stop the flow of money, and it took three different meetings in the White House, three different orders by President Bush to sever relations with Chalabi before before the administration finally did so. And this, you know, comes from several sources, including one of whom is on the record, a man named Rob Richer, who is the director, who is our top spy in the Middle East. He was the director of clandestine operations in Iraq during the war. And he was sitting in the Oval Office when all of this was going down. And, you know, he said he had never seen anybody stonewall, drag their feet, slow roll an order by the commander-in-chief, especially in the time of war. It was shocking to them, and to him, to Rob Richer, it was evidence of the depth to which these neoconservatives were committed, not only to Chalabi, but to their idea of post-Saddam Iraq.
And the amazing thing is, Richard Bonin, that the Chalabi, despite the fact that he betrayed the U.S. in such a fundamental way, he then is invited back in by Ryan Crocker and General Petraeus, and he betrays us again and directly causes the death of, you know, hundreds of American soldiers through the SADS unit, didn't he? I mean,
yeah. Well, what happened is during the height of the Civil War in Iraq, 2006, 2007, when it looked like the whole thing was going to unravel and just become an unmitigated disaster akin to the end of the Vietnam War with the helicopter taking off of the embassy roof, when it looked like we were heading in that direction, our policymakers were desperate to work with anybody who could salvage the situation. And whatever you say about Chalabi, the man is brilliant, and he is very Western in his ability to get things done. It's very hard, you know, after decades of dictatorship in Iraq. It's very hard to get people to take initiative and get things done. Chalabi is very good at that. And they reached out to him and made him a part of the counterinsurgency, improving basic services in Iraq, and brought him back into the tent. And just when it looked like he was about to consolidate his comeback with the Americans, according to people in the know, he betrayed the U.S. again. We were locked in a deadly battle with the Shia militia run by Muqtada al-Sadr. This was in Basra in the south and in Sadr City right outside of Baghdad. And it looked like for a while Muqtada al-Sadr's Shia militia, which is backed by Iran, was about to win in those two cities in this armed conflict, just brutal. And we were on the verge, the Iraqi government of Maliki was on the verge of collapsing, and Chalabi was secretly egging on Muqtada al-Sadr's militia to keep the fight up while talking to Tehran and saying, listen, when the Maliki government falls, remember who your friends are, and basically lobbying for himself to become the prime minister of Iraq should the Maliki government fall. And our U.S. intelligence sources picked up that communication, and that was it. Then the end of the U.S.-Chalabi relationship was final. You know, as far as they're concerned, he's dead to them.
Talk about
deal with him at all.
Talk about American blood on his hands, and not to mention the treasure that he received directly. It's just an extraordinary story that you've brought forth here, Richard Bonin. Just in closing, though, you spent, 60? You met him with 60 times, is that right?
No, I first met him shortly after the attacks of 9/11 in January of 2002, so I've known him for about 10 years. But for the book, I interviewed him for 60 hours.
60 hours, sorry.
On tape,
right.
And then many, many hours off tape.
So where is this guy today? He should be hanging beside Saddam Hussein, but he's not. So
you know, you can't be. I find it difficult to be completely that harsh on Chalabi. You have to remember, he, for whatever his reasons, he opposed Saddam Hussein against his own interests, and he has survived about a dozen assassination attempts. And there is a degree of nobility in taking on Saddam Hussein, who, after all, murdered probably about a million Iraqis, gassed them, murdered them, his soldiers raped their women. I mean, it was an evil regime, and there is a degree of nobility in opposing Saddam. But Chalabi is ultimately out for himself, and he, in his heart of hearts, believes what's best for him is best for Iraq. And the CIA did a psychoanalysis of him, like they do all political leaders, and they concluded that he is a narcissist. He is literally unable to separate in his mind his own interests from those of Iraq. And so he is constantly pursuing his own interests. And sometimes they smack of amorality. And I think that's why he, you know, in the end, he had so much opposition against him inside the U.S. Government.
Today, or maybe I should revise my death wish for him and suggest that Pearl and Wolfowitz and all the neocons get strung up, because they allowed this country to be conned by this person who was so mendacious and so duplicitous. At any rate, we've run out of time, but I really recommend your book, Harley, because as now we witness the end of our sorry chapter in Iraq, this is important information. This really explains how we got into this war and why.
And well, thank you for your time, Ian. I appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with Richard Bonin. His producer at CBS News is 60 Minutes, working with Leslie Stahl. He's won 5 Emmys as well as an Overseas Press Club Award for his reporting in Iraq. He's the author of the new book, Arrows in the Night, Ahmed Chalabi's Long Journey to Triumph in Iraq. So what do we learn from today's background briefing? We began talking with a columnist with the Washington Post and an executive editor of the American Prospect, Harold Meyerson, giving us an update on the House Republicans' latest example of bullheaded brinkmanship and this kind of slash-and-burn ideological approach that they have, where compromise is impossible, and they'll have a tantrum until they get all of their demands met, and they'll even shut down the entire U.S. government. In this case, they will deny unemployment benefits to millions of Americans and a tax cut to 160 million Americans. So that is where we're at in Washington. And, of course, the Democrats, feckless as they are, have fallen for taking the payment of this extension of unemployment and payroll tax cut. They took off the table their insistence that it get paid for with a surtax on millionaires and billionaires. The Republicans have been able to use this leverage of the Keystone Pipeline, which is entirely designed to distract the public from their real fealty to the billionaires who they'll go to the mat for. And in general, it is yet another disgrace, but of course it's a self-inflicted wound on the Republicans, and they probably will come out the losers with this one. It's not a Democratic victory, it's a Republican loss. And then we talked about what really is the true nature of the regime in North Korea. The CIA doesn't know a damn thing about the place, and most of what you read in the press is nonsense. And this Brian Myers, professor of international studies at Dongseo University in Busan, South Korea, the author of The Cleanest Race, How North Koreans See Themselves and Why It Matters, really does explain what the true nature of that regime is, that it's not a far-left communist regime. It's more like a right-wing fascist monarchy like Imperial Japan was under Emperor Hirohito. And once you understand the national socialist nature, the Nazi nature of this regime, they're not expansionists. They don't want to take over the world, but they are a race-based culture. Then it begins to make sense, all of the weeping in the street and the worship of the great leader, the dear leader, and now the great, or the dear successor, I guess he's called, or the great successor. And then finally, we spoke with Richard Bonin, a 60 Minutes producer, who's written this brilliant book, Arrows in the Night, Ahmad Chalabi's Long Journey to Triumph in Iraq. This really explains what the Iraq War was all about and how this amazing crook conned the U.S. into this disastrous war, all the while working for the Iranians. It's an amazing story. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Love.